Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni, and here's a taste of what we'll be talking about today. Pope Benedict XVI appeals to aid agencies to spare no effort in securing all necessary assistance to the scores of thousands of civilians who have fled Sri Lanka's northern war zone. And we take a look at the conflict in Sri Lanka and at the awful escalation of violence that has been described as a bloodbath. In celebration of this year's World Communications Day, the Pontifical Council for Social Communications launches a new website especially directed to young people. And film critic Peter Malone, who is at the Cannes Film Festival, tells us about some of the films competing for this year's awards. Pope Benedict XVI has called on Catholic and other aid agencies to spare no effort in securing necessary food and medical supplies to the scores of thousands of civilians who have fled Sri Lanka's northern war zone. The Pope's appeal came on Sunday as the Tamil Tiger rebels conceded defeat in their 25-year civil war after launching waves of suicide attacks to repel a final assault by troops determined to annihilate them. Chris Altieri has this report.
President Mahinda Rajapaksa had declared victory over the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam the day before, even as combat raged in the island's northeast, and the military said it was freeing the last of thousands of trapped civilians. By midday Sunday, the military said troops had freed all the civilians being held by the Tigers inside an area that was less than a single square kilometer. A total of 72,000 people had fled the area since Thursday of this past week.
Chiedo inoltre alle istituzioni umanitarie, comprese quelle cattoliche, di non lasciare nulla di intentato per venire incontro alle urgenti necessità alimentari e mediche dei profughi.
Speaking to pilgrims ahead of this Sunday's Regina Caeli address, Pope Benedict XVI called on humanitarian agencies, including Catholic organizations, to leave nothing untried in their efforts to secure refugees' access to life's basic necessities.
Ed elevo le mie preghiere al Signore affinché affretti il giorno della riconciliazione e della pace.
The Holy Father entrusted the whole country of Sri Lanka to the protection of the Virgin Mary and asked God to hasten the arrival of full reconciliation and lasting peace. Pope Benedict also reflected on his recently concluded pilgrimage to the Holy Land, saying he had gone in order to serve the causes of Christian unity, interreligious dialogue with Jews and Muslims, and peace building in the region.
La storia della salvezza comincia con l'elezione di un uomo, Abramo, e di un popolo, Israele.
The Pope said the Holy Land is a symbol of God's love for his people and for the whole of humanity, and also a symbol of freedom and peace as God wills it for every one of his children. He went on to say that history has made the Holy Land the symbol of divisions and never-ending conflict among brothers. The Holy Land, said Pope Benedict, has become a sort of fifth gospel, as some have called it, which, by virtue of its history, can be considered a microcosm that sums up humanity's tiring journey toward the kingdom of justice, love, and peace. I'm Chris Altieri.
Thanks, of course, to Chris Altieri for that report. Meanwhile, I asked Chris, who works on the news desk here at Vatican Radio, to tell me more about the conflict in Sri Lanka and about how it has escalated in the past years.
The Tamil Rebellion began in 1983 after years of unsuccessful attempts to address the Tamil minority's complaints of systematically unfair treatment. At its height, the Tamil separatists, led by a group called the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, had established a de facto state in the island's north and east with an executive, courts of justice, basic services, and a tax system. The Tigers fought for nearly two decades and entered into a ceasefire agreement brokered by Norway in 2002. That agreement began unraveling in 2005, and in early 2008, The government announced a formal end to the ceasefire and the beginning of an offensive to break the rebellion once and for all. During the final phase of the war, the rebels' northern stronghold continued to shrink, with many civilians fleeing the fighting and many others remaining trapped behind the lines until its final hours.
The government of Sri Lanka, they are rejoicing that they have militarily overcome terrorism by making the tigers surrender. And this has been a very costly war because a lot of people have died and a lot of people have been displaced.
The Bishop of Jaffna Diocese in northern Sri Lanka, Thomas Savandaranayagam, told us the government needs to ensure the basic necessities of the thousands who fled the war zone, and that the cause of national reconciliation and reconstruction is best served by a rapid return of the refugees to their former lives.
And the government must try as much as possible to settle them early, not to have them in the camps as refugees, dependent on the government for their handouts, etc., but take them back to their own places, having cleared all the mines, etc., and all that, and given them the way of living which they had been doing earlier. If they were farmers, to do farming. If they were fishermen, to do fishing, etc.
Bishop Savandaranayagam says the church is uniquely placed to play a role in the repairing of Sri Lanka's national discourse.
The church, since it comprises of the Sinhalese and the Tamils, they must work towards a just solution to the problem.
I'm Chris Altieri.
As Chris was explaining, the Tigers had been fighting for a separate state for Tamils in the north and east of Sri Lanka since the 1970s, where more than 70,000 people have been killed and thousands displaced. A Sri Lankan military announcement, meanwhile, on Monday said the leader of the Tamil Tiger rebels, Velupillai Prabhakaran, is dead. This announcement came shortly after the military said it had surrounded Prabhakaran in a tiny patch of jungle in the northeast, where the Sri Lankan army claims to have defeated the rebels and liberated the entire country. The news follows a dramatic upsurge of violence in the past days, during which Sri Lankan government forces had announced they were on the brink of the total defeat of the rebels, who were clinging onto an ever-shrinking pocket of land, described as being no bigger than Central Park in New York. But as well as the remaining fighters, many thousands of civilians occupied this small area of territory, and thousands of people have been killed during the fighting. At the weekend, the United Nations described what was going on as a bloodbath. My colleague Lydia O'Kane spoke to Gordon Weiss, the spokesman for the UN in Sri Lanka, about these distressing reports.
Gordon, the first thing I just wanted to ask you, we've been hearing reports of shelling inside the hospital in the conflict zone, reports of at least 45 people killed. That's with hospital sources. I don't know what you've been hearing. Have you been hearing any more about that?
The same sources are the ones that we rely on for a lot of what we hear going on inside the combat zone. We consider them pretty reliable sources. Certainly in lieu of anything else, if it wasn't for them, we would know nothing about what's going on inside, and we would never have heard about the hundreds who were killed over the weekend.
Yes, I was just going to come to that, what the UN was saying again, described a bloodbath, basically 400 people killed and over 1,000 injured. More of the same, and I was reading that many of the casualties from that fighting were taken to that hospital. Would that be right?
That's right. It's not the first time that these makeshift hospitals have been hit. It's happened on a number of occasions. Again, it's an inevitable product of a great deal of fighting taking place in a very small area of land with a lot of civilians around.
If what is happening is true, it just seems to be man's inhumanity to man. The death toll keeps rising. People are suffering injuries, wounds. It seems to be just getting worse and worse.
Yes, I think it's always one has to stretch one's imagination to imagine people dying in such great numbers with such apparent frequency. But it does seem that there have been thousands of people who have been killed and injured in a very short space of time in these past couple of months. The reports that we have been consistent. It's not just from the doctors inside the zone. We often cross-check what we hear with Catholic priests, for example, who are working inside the zone, as well as our own staff who were inside the zone.
Just looking at it from an international level, we're hearing about, you know, diplomats from particular countries like the UK, France, Austria, saying that the UN Security Council should address the crisis. Other countries are saying it's an internal issue, but it does seem to be really now grabbing the attention.
One would hope so. It's taken a long time, and as I say, many thousands of people have been killed and injured up to this point. The problem, of course, with Sri Lanka is that this is a war that's been going on for a very, very long time, more than 25 years now, and the origins of the war are sort of obscured in the mists of time. So it's the type of conflict that doesn't readily impress itself on the news cycle. It sort of comes and goes. But yes, one would hope that with this level of death and injury and suffering that more attention and more concerted attention will come about.
I'm just thinking, Gordon, about the hospital itself. If the hospital, the second time this hospital has been hit, and you can imagine, I'd imagine there aren't very many supplies left in that hospital, and the situation in a hospital when you need supplies, when you need everything to be working, when a place like that's hit, it must be just have disastrous consequences.
Yes, well, I think the only reason why there is a hospital at all, it's really, at this point, merely a place where people congregate who happen to be injured or dying. I think that medical drugs and bandages and sutures and things like that are virtually non-existent. There are some medical personnel operating from that point. They have been saying for some time that they are really operating in quite a useless way. They're sort of just trying to bandage people up as best they can, patch people up. But one imagines that there is a very high death toll because people can't get proper medical attention. This is part of the overall problem. We haven't been able to get in sufficient quantities of food, and nor have we been able to get in sufficient quantities of drugs and bandages and things like that for quite a long time now. We note this from the condition of people coming out. They have a very high level of malnutrition. Certainly, months ago, there were more than a quarter of the under 5-year-old children in the camps in northern Sri Lanka were suffering from malnutrition, severe malnutrition. I would hazard a guess that it is much, much higher inside the combat zone.
And the announcement of the death of the leader of the Tamil Tiger rebels sparked mass celebrations around the country, with people pouring into the streets of Colombo, dancing and singing. However, his death in battle could still turn him into a martyr for other Tamil separatists. Meanwhile, European Union nations have called for an independent war crimes probe into the killing of civilians. The Britain Foreign Secretary, in fact, says there have been very grave allegations of war crimes on both sides of the conflict, and they should be properly investigated. In a statement, the EU's foreign minister also appealed to Sri Lanka's government to urgently let in UN aid groups to help provide much-needed food and medical care to civilians caught in the fighting, and to seek reconciliation with the country's minority Tamil population. Every year, the Church celebrates World Communications Day. This year, it falls on the 24th of May. That's next Sunday. And for the occasion, Pope Benedict XVI has a special message for young people across the world. The theme for 2009 is New Technologies, New Relationships, Promoting a Culture of Respect, Dialogue and Friendship. And also for the occasion, the Pontifical Council for Social Communications is launching a new website, it too, specially directed to young people. Of course, the site has been designed with the needs, tastes and rhythms of the digital age generations in mind, with vivacious graphics as well as with Facebook, iPhone and YouTube applications. My friend and colleague Philippa Hitchin spoke to the president of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications, Archbishop Claudio Mariacelli, about the exciting new initiative.
So, Archbishop Celli, you're launching this new internet site for World Communications Day. Tell us how the idea came about. What is the aim of this site?
The idea came from the fact that the message is certainly addressed to everybody, but mainly to the young generation, the digital generation.
as the Holy Father calls the young people in this message. And we thought that it was good to present the message to the young generation through technologies that the young generations know and use. So we thought that it was good to have such a site called Pope to You, a site envisioned in a young way. And so we think that probably the young generation, the young people could find in such a presentation a good way, not only to know the message, but to spread the message. And the nice way is that now we have prepared some postcards with an image of the Holy Father and some words taken from his messages or his speeches. And we invite the young people to use such postcards, to send them to their friends, in order to spread around messages and insights from the gospel. Is light spread around. And so I think we hope that such an initiative can be really used by the young generation.
It's very user-friendly, the graphics are simple, and it's using the latest technologies, iPhone technology, Facebook. Who was the brains behind it all?
Oh, the brain is a young Italian priest, Father Pedrini. He was proposing it to us, and we thought that was good to accept it. And now he was here with us in this presentation. So the site is opening his activities next Thursday under the umbrella of the Pontifical Council of Social Communications. But we are using the idea and the invention of Father Pedrini.
It's available in several languages, isn't it?
It is working in 5 languages in order to cover the vast majority of the young people around the world. And so we hope that it will be accepted and appreciated.
It puts the Vatican's Council for Social Communications rather in the forefront, doesn't it? Engaging with these new technologies in quite an audacious way, perhaps.
I think that the Holy Father, with his message, is inviting or pushing us to do this. Because the main goal of this message is new technologies, new relationships. And so we think that the Pontifical Council itself has to use new technologies to promote new relationships around the world. And we are at the service of the Holy Father. And we think that we must take advantage of what new technologies are offering us in this moment.
You're hoping that it'll become a permanent site, aren't you? Although it is just being launched for this occasion.
Young people will help us to decide. We don't know exactly what will be their reaction, but if the reaction is favorable, we can see what we can do in the future.
And that was Philippa Hitchin speaking to the president of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications, Archbishop Claudio Mariacelli. And now we go over to our friend, film critic Peter Malone, who heads the film office at Cygnus, the World Catholic Association for Communication. Right now he's in Cannes, following the ongoing International Film Festival there. The festival is due to end on Sunday the 24th of May, with the prize-giving ceremonies, the main award being the Palme d'Or. Okay, Peter, so in Cannes today, in the middle of the glittering Cannes Film Festival, quite a high-powered lineup of competitors. Would you like to tell me who the big names are?
Well, you're right, Linda. It's an enormous lineup of famous directors this year. I should say the critics at Cannes and of Cannes are never happy. And there's always something wrong with the selection and usually something wrong with the opening film. But they tried last year to be a bit more innovative and have lesser-known directors, so that got criticised. 2 years ago, for the 50th anniversary, they invited a lot of winners back. That actually went over not too badly. So I'm presuming they have that in mind, because this year the selection is, as you say, rather high-powered, and I think more than half the directors represented in the main competition have actually won before.
They look as though they're actually Oscar winners, a lot of them, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, at the top of my list is Pedro Almodovar.
Right.
He won, actually, in 1999 for All About My Mother, got the best director. And also his Bad Education was the opening film in 2004. So he's a bit of a Cannes favourite. His Volver did an interesting thing a couple of years ago. Penelope Cruz was the main actress, as she is in his film Broken Embraces this year.
So it's Broken Embraces this year.
Yes.
¡Pare!
¿Dónde vas?
Te dejo con esto.
Por favor, Lena.
Adiós.
Lena, escúchame. Lena.
But she didn't get the acting award just by herself. They gave it to the whole ensemble of women actors in the film. So Almodovar will certainly be welcomed as usual.
And his women.
And his women. Penelope Cruz again. And now she has an Oscar for appearing in a Woody Allen
That's
film.
Right.
So she's got some status internationally, apart from all the Spanish and Italian awards that she in fact has won.
Who else is on the top of your list?
Well, Jane Campion originated from New Zealand and then moved to Australia. So I thought I'd impartially mention her.
I'll never forget that beautiful film, An Angel at My Table, I think it was called.
An Angel at My Table, yes, and she also had a winning film with the piano. So this time she's here with a film made in Britain, and it's a biography of Keats. It may not be a long film because he didn't live all that long, but it's a romance about the romantic poet Keats. That's called Bright Star, and the rather wispy Ben Whishaw, who was in Brideshead Revisited as Sebastian, is going to be Keats. So I think we can look forward to that, a bit of English culture.
Absolutely, a film for my heart, for sure. I see Ang Lee is also one of the competitors.
Ang Lee is one of the most unpredictable directors I've ever come across. That he made his films in Taiwan, and they were very Chinese, The Wedding Breakfast and things like that. And then suddenly he's making Sense and Sensibility, so a Chinese interpreting Jane Austen and making a success of it. He did The Civil War with Ride with the Devil, and he tried The Hulk, which wasn't so good, and Brokeback Mountain, of course, and Lust Caution. This one's about the Woodstock Festival, of all things, so called Taking Woodstock.
Look at this. Some hippie thing's going to get cancelled unless they find a new place for the concert.
Wow, Janis Joplin.
Grateful Dead, The Who.
Well, the locals killed it.
Bummer, man.
Can you connect me with something called the Woodstock Ventures?
So I haven't seen it yet, but who knows with Ang Lee. He certainly is a man of wide range.
Could be fun, I think. And what about, I see here, Alain Resnais?
Well, he's only about 87 this year.
Yes.
So he has been around quite a long time. I liked his earlier films more than some of his more recent ones. He's become very soft and romantic in the more recent years. So perhaps I'm longing for, you know, the back in the days of Hiroshima Mon Amour.
Yes.
And last year at Marienbad. Mm-hmm. The only trouble is they're about 50 years ago, so it's. I think we need to acknowledge what he's doing in his 70s and 80s. But yes, he'll be there as well.
Who else would you like to pick out?
Well, we'd better mention that the UK is represented by Andrea Arnold with a film called Fish Tank.
Get some clothes on, mate.
I've got some clothes on.
You're half naked.
You don't normally care.
Yeah, well, I do now, so get dressed.
She won a jury prize a couple of years ago with a Scottish story called Red Road. Came at an angle. People weren't expecting it, but she received great praise. So she's here. Ken Loach is here as well. And he's got one about football. I think his writer, the Scots Paul Laverty, must like football, because a couple of years ago, Loach contributed to a portmanteau film called Tickets. And he had a group of young Scots going to Italy to watch a football match. Mm-hmm. So This looking for Eric happens to be the player Eric Cantona, who's appearing as himself.
Sometimes we forget that you're just a man.
I'm not a man. I am Cantona.
It's a contemporary quest, one might say, in elevated language, looking for a football star.
I see here that another controversial director is present, and that's Lars von Trier with a film called Antichrist.
You have to have the courage to stay in the situation that frightens you.
Do you love me? I can't do this. The ground is burning.
The ground is not
burning. Oh, yes, as soon as I saw that on the list, I thought, what is he up to this time?
Yes.
The interesting thing about Lars von Trier is that in the late 90s he became a Catholic. What kind of Catholic, nobody is too sure, because he's certainly an eccentric type. But again, he's been popular at Cannes. I don't know whether you ever saw Breaking the Waves from the late 90s.
I will never forget that film.
Yes, he certainly makes an impact. Dramatic stories, the human condition, suffering women. But that continued. He won with a film that which I don't like at all, with, what's her name?
Nicole Kidman. Oh, with Bjork, no. Dancing in the Dark.
I've seen it all. I have seen the trees. I have seen the willow leaves.
I must say, I really didn't like that one. But anyhow, he got the Palme d'Or for that. But in the meantime, yes, he met up with Nicole Kidman and they made Dogville.
That's right.
And she couldn't go into the sequel, and that was called Mandalay. So he's certainly very striking, very different.
Does he still adhere to is it called the Dogma 4 principles?
No, I think he's moved away. Well, I'm sure that he would say, yes, he does, but he's moved away. I think that with some of his films, he's allowed for artificial lighting and sound and some of the less strict interpretation of his purest dogma principles.
I've zoomed into the closing film, which I would love to see.
Yes, I don't know much about that one, but
I don't either. It's just the title has really struck me. Coco Chanel and
Igor
Stravinsky.
Yes. Yes, I'm not sure, though, they were making a film with Audrey Tautou about Coco Chanel.
Now, she was the Amélie, wasn't she?
She was, yes. And she was also in The Da Vinci Code.
That's right.
But whether this is the one, I'd need to look up the books, because it's coming at the end. So, yes, it's the closing film with a bit of fashion and style, I suppose.
Okay.
Actually, before that, we're going to see Terry Gilliam's film, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, and it's being advertised, as it is, as Heath Ledger's last film. I'm sure there'll be a run on that, but I see that it has been...
I thought his last film was the one he actually won an Oscar for.
No, he was filming this one when he died.
Right.
And so they reinvented aspects of the screenplay so that other actors could do the part that he was doing. And Colin Farrell, Jude Law and Johnny Depp are all performing this character that basically is the Heath Ledger character in it. How that'll work out, we'll have to wait till the end of the week to see.
Okay, Peter. Well, I can't wait to speak to you when you're back from Cannes, then.
I'll be able to tell you about the Heath Ledger film next time.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Linda.
Bye-bye. That's all from the English Feature Programme today, and from me, Linda Bordoni. But we will be back at the same time tomorrow. So join us then. Laudetur Jesus Christus.